Mediums are people who claim to be able to speak to the dead.
I've spent my whole life looking beyond the edges of our reality.
It's like an act.
Even as a child, I saw things that would break a grown man.
One says that the spirits are communicating with her through blinking.
But that thing.
I've had people say that they see it as a white space. I personally think they're just making up whatever.
Hello, this is Hey Lesson, the podcast where we ask clever people silly questions inspired by video games. I'm Brendan Caldwell, your host, and I am here to underhandedly teach you things through the lens of popular games, with the help of some friends, of course. Today we're talking about horror game The Medium, a creepy third-person adventure in which you play a medium, somebody who talks to the spirits of the dead. But is this really possible? No, it's not. And we know it's not because this week we spoke to a fact-checking vigilante skeptic who performs sting operations on real-life mediums to debunk their claims of being able to talk to the dead. She's got a lot of interesting stuff to tell us, so please keep listening to hear from her. Before we get into any of that, let me introduce my guest co-host this week, who's going to talk about the video game itself. It's journalist and critic Edwin Evans Thirlwell. How are you doing?
Hello, I am doing okay, thank you.
You've been playing this video game to review. Before we go into it too much, where might people recognise you from?
So I'm mostly found at Eurogamer and Edge and occasionally on The Guardian, but I've been kind of knocking around for donkey's years, so I've sort of written for little bits and pieces for everybody over the centuries.
So could you just explain the game to people who maybe haven't heard of it? Like, what is The Medium?
Sure, so it's a third-person survival horror, and it's set in Poland in sort of more or less the present day, and it concerns a medium called Marianne, who is obviously somebody who can communicate with the dead. And in her case, specifically, she can actually go into the spirit plane, which kind of sets up this gameplay dynamic of you can kind of move in the material world and the spirit plane at the same time. The screen splits down the middle and you can explore these environments using kind of fixed camera perspectives, similar to the classic Resident Evils, and solve puzzles and avoid monsters. The story is kind of about her going to this ruined Soviet workers' resort, which harbors an awful lot of malevolent psychic energy, I think it's fair to say, and sort of dealing with some personal revelations there. She's one of those orphans who has no memory of her youth, one of those old chestnuts, and so she's trying to work out what exactly is going on.
One of those video game protagonists.
Yes.
Who has no clue why she's where she is.
She kind of, like, you start the game and she's her sort of foster parent runs a funeral parlor, which is just a great place to grow up when you're a medium, I guess. Lots of kind of material to work with. It's definitely quite a theme. It's, having said that, it's not a very, like, it's more of a game about the sort of creeping atmosphere than it is about the jump scares.
We're going to talk a bit more about that kind of stuff and the chatting to the phantoms and the puzzles and the story a little bit, maybe. The game itself is coming out tomorrow by the time that this episode airs. But before we go deeper into it, we wanted to know more about real life mediums. We wanted to know how they performed their abilities, so to speak. How can they be talking to dead people? And if they're not, how did they fool so many people into believing that they can speak to the dead? So to that end, I spoke to Susan Gerbic. She is part of a hardened group of Wikipedia editors who fact check and try to keep Wikipedia as free from hokum as possible. But she also organizes a group of skeptics who aim to debunk mediums by performing what she calls stings at their shows. So here's what she had to tell us.
It all starts with a dead girl.
First of all, I just want you to introduce yourself to our listeners. Who are you and what do you do?
I am Susan Gerbic. I am known as the Wikipediatrician. Affectionately, they call me that. I'm also someone who debunks grief vampires, which are people who supposedly communicate with the dead. I run an international Wikipedia editing team that specializes in maintaining and correcting and building Wikipedia pages concerning science, scientific skepticism, claims of the paranormal, and I have fingers in more pies than there are pies on Pi Day.
So if somebody writes a Wikipedia entry for, like, astral projection or mind reading or something like that, you'll be in that Wikipedia entry trying to make sure that it's all factual.
Yes, and I have a team of doing that. I don't need to do it so much anymore. We've written a little over 1,560 Wikipedia pages. The Wikipedia pages that we have written and maintained have been viewed over 79 million times.
Okay.
So we're trying to make sure that Wikipedia stays sciencey, scientifically literate.
Every story has two sides. A regular, rational one, but also a darker and deeper truth.
Right now we're playing a video game about a medium. She can see the dead, she says. She speaks to them. It's a horror game. But could you explain to us very briefly what a medium does in real life, or what they claim to be able to do?
Okay, so what they claim to do, there's a long history of spiritualism in the United States going back to, I guess, the 1800s. People claim to be able to communicate with the dead. And nowadays, it's become easier to make the claim because TV shows and news media are happy to throw the psychic of the day onto a morning show and have them make some predictions.
Is there some similarity in what all mediums claim to be able to see or hear? In the video game, for instance, this medium can sort of see a whole other realm around her, like on top of the real world. Is it that type of thing that they claim that they can do, or is it more vague?
They're all varied. What these mediums claim, there's so many different things. I don't think that most of the mediums that you talk to, and mediums are people who claim to be able to speak to the dead, which is different from a person who says they're psychic. A psychic is more somebody who, maybe tells the future or can tell if you have a curse on you or something like that, but not necessarily claiming to speak to dead people. But they're all different. It's like an act. Whatever they come up with. I have one I just researched recently. She's into blinking. And no, that is not something I'm misstating. She blinks like rapidly and says that the spirits are communicating with her through blinking. And she uses the word blinking all the time. I'm blinking six. So that must mean on the sixth month or maybe the sixth day, does the six have anything to do with, that's how her thing is with blinking. I've had people say that they see it as a white space and people enter into it. I personally think they're just making up whatever.
As the listener might have already realized, you're not totally convinced of these people's powers.
Oh, it would be awesome if they could. Boy, let me tell you, what a world we'd be in if we could really communicate with the dead. That'd be great.
I've spent my whole life looking beyond the edges of our reality.
So when a medium correctly tells someone in a crowd, say, or a person that they're talking to, the name of a dead relative, for example, how do you explain that?
Well, first off, the burden of proof is on them to explain it, not me. That's how it works. But if we want to go further and assume that the burden of proof is on the skeptical or the person who is not making the claim, there are usually three different elements that you see whenever you're watching a psychic supposedly do their thing. One is cold reading, which is generalities that are thrown out that fit most people. The second thing is hot reading, which is my specialty, is whenever these grief vampires go and look at obituaries or Facebook pages, social media, and then they say that they're getting the information from the spirit world. And the third way they look like they appear to be real is the editors who are doing the magic behind the scenes, as you will be doing with this interview we're doing. You pick out the best parts and you take out all the ums and ahs, and next thing you got is some magic.
That's exactly right.
And there's multiple ways. The larger the room is, the more likely the medium is going to get something right by throwing things out. The law of large numbers. They make things that sound specific that really aren't very specific. Who died of a heart attack? Who had a miscarriage? Who had a fire in their home? And somebody in the audience is going to raise their hand and say, that must be me. And then they can go on from there. These people are very skilled. I mean, they've done thousands of readings, so don't underestimate their skill.
Hi there.
Oh, hi. You startled me.
I did, didn't I? You look real scared.
A lot of times they play the game of names. I had one just recently. She was talking about a rose. There's a rose and might be somebody's name, or it could be she had roses or whatever, and it was your grandmother. And so I looked at, here in America, we have something called the Social Security Baby Name Index. Everything everybody's been named, first names. male or female for going back to like 1900. And I was looking it up, and in 1910, 1920, and 1930, Rose was one of the most common names. So for the psychic to throw out the name Rose, it could be a first name, a middle name, a nickname. It could be the dog's name. It could be that they work for a company, Rose Perfumes. I mean, it could be so many different things. And so the believer, the person in the audience, wants to believe so badly that they will try to make a connection.
Thomas, do you know him?
Let me think. I've heard that name before.
You've used this these phrases like cold reading and hot reading. And the cold reading, I'm guessing, is that, you know, saying vague things that sound specific or trying to go to name out of someone by naming letters. On the opposite end of that, a hot reading is something that's much more detailed for a certain reason.
Right. So hot reading, as I said, is my specialty. We had a woman just contacted me that a psychic told her that her son was in spirit. He's been dead 6 years and he's there with Connor. And she went, oh! And he said, who's Connor? And she says, it's the family dog. And he said, yes, because he's saying, your son is saying that he's there with the family dog. And she was amazed until she went and looked up her son's obituary. And there very clearly says that her son died 6 years ago. And he leaves behind the family dog named Connor. So that's considered a hot read. And I'm a bit of a snoop myself. I'm really socially, I do a lot of genealogy. So I have access to something called ancestry.com. I also have newspapers.com and other ways of finding information. And I'm just really good at finding information on people. And I have a team of people called the Guerrilla Skeptics that also can do this as well. And you just get pretty good at finding obituaries and looking through the obituaries, trying to find information. Some psychics like to hot read a lot. That's their whole thing, is to just look you up and repeat it as if they're getting it from spirit.
Wait, I know you. You were that boy. Bernard, was it?
So there are ways to find out that a medium is doing a hot reading.
Mm-hmm.
You have some experience in performing what you call sting operations on mediums who perform.
Yes.
How do you perform a sting operation on a medium?
It's so much fun. Oh my gosh. It's the greatest way of hanging out with some friends. So you got to figure out what the modus operandi of that particular psychic is. I mean, are they on Instagram? Are they even hot reading? Like I said, most don't. Most are just cold readers. And if you're going to be investigating a cold reader, you just get a recording of it. Then you listen to it multiple times, slowing it down. And you can see there's just wordplay going on. Hot readers, what we've done multiple times is we have Facebook pages that are not associated with our real Facebook pages. And they're having friendships and relationships with other fake Facebook pages. And they just go about their day and they have, you know, something happens at work and maybe they had an argument with their spouse and, oh my gosh, the lady next door died and it's just so awful, you know, and whatever happens, you know, and they share pictures of their dogs and cats and they just have these lives. And so when we're going to attend a psychic event, you can tell the psychic that fake Facebook page is going to be there. You know, you would buy your ticket under that name. You would maybe go to the psychic's Facebook page and say, oh, I'm so excited. I'm going to be talking to such and such psychic today, leaving your Facebook page totally exposed so that the psychic can go in and just click on your name and see what's going on in your life, whatever they need to find out. So they can go in and look at that. It's like leaving some bacon out there for him, you know.
All these people, they weren't just killed. Their spirits were ripped apart, broken beyond repair.
The one that I'm famous for is called Operation Pizza Roll. The bait we threw out there was two Facebook pages. My husband, who I'm not married, had heart conditions. I was trying to get in touch with my dead twin brother named Andy, who died of pancreatic cancer a few years ago. And
these are all fake.
These are fake. I have no twin brother. I have no brother named Andy. Nobody's
died. This was a character.
Yeah, it's a character. And what's important for people to understand is that it's double blinded. The account of that fake Facebook page is being run by somebody else who's not communicating with the person who attends the event. So the person who attends the event is given basic information, like I was. I was told I have a brother who died of pancreatic cancer. He was a twin and his name is Andy. That's all you need to know, Susan. And then when the psychic gets up on stage and says, I'm getting a twin brother who wants to reach his sister, and I'm feeling something about in this area here in the stomach, I think it's cancer, then I know to raise my hand. And so I raise my hand, and then he goes on and tells me all the other stuff that's on the Facebook page. I have to nod and agree, not knowing what's on that Facebook page. I'm just nodding and agreeing and pretending to cry and being very emotional. And there's audio of it up on my website, so if anybody wants to hear it.
I have to tell you, just as soon as I'm tapping into you, somebody's making me aware of cancer. Is this your brother? Did he have cancer?
Yes.
Okay. Because he's shown me cancer.
And then after the event's over and we've got it all recorded, we can compare the reading to the Facebook page. And that's when the person who was the sitter is finally made aware of how close they got. And in a hot reader's case, you're going to find that it's pretty damn close.
Yeah, well, both of ours did.
No, but I think it's your twin. Did he quit smoking?
Yes.
Okay.
In this horror game, the medium, it's quite nasty. Like, there's a lot of like monstrous kind of things happening. There's been murders, you know, there have been nasty things have happened to people. Mediums in real life don't seem to be troubled that much by, say, spirits with like negative energy or something. In fact, they rarely say anything negative to their subjects. Why is that? Surely statistically you'd expect a medium to run into a nasty ghost once in a while. They would say something bad to their son or daughter.
They're here to make money, so they're not going to be telling you that you I see bad things for you. They're going to say only good things, unless you're one of these people who are. And this happens a lot. I have a friend named Bob Nygaard, who is a private investigator who has put many psychics in jail or busted for crimes. What they do is they say they see a curse on you, and I need to take your money's dirty, or your jewelry's dirty, or these gold coins are dirty. So I need you to. First off, you know, they say, you got to buy a candle and I'm going to pray over that. Take this lock of hair and put it under your pillow overnight. And that's a whole nother wing of it. But, you know, I think about these TV psychics who are more my specialty, and how do you function? You know, if you really were communicating with the dead, I think you would be not mentally stable. It's not like the Sixth Sense, you know, this little kid's walking around and he sees dead people everywhere. I mean, even think about that, what that would be like. That would be horrendous, and you would just never be able to function.
Even as a child, I saw things that would break a grown man.
Think, you couldn't have a relationship with another human being because you would be constantly seeing bad or whatever. You couldn't go to the grocery store. You couldn't interact with humans. I just can't. I mean, the person's delivering your newspaper or your mail, and you take a look at them, and they get this whatever glow around them, and you see demons coming after me. it gets to be absurd after a while. And at the point that this can't be real, it has to be fantasy.
Some people listening might be thinking, you know, why go to the trouble? Why debunk these people when so many of their audience would leave their shows feeling like they really have spoken to someone, like their mother or their sister or whoever? You know, what harm are these mediums doing, really?
That's a really valid question, and that gets down to it. Now, I'm really anti-lying to people, especially lying to people who are grieving and who are desperate to hear. And yes, they may leave the event feeling an euphoria that they've just had a contact with their child or their whatever, and they're crying and it feels amazing, and they tell everyone they know, and they're still being lied to. And it's wrong to take advantage of people's grief for that. Plus, a lot of the times these people come to the realization that they were lied to, especially in the hot reading. They also give a lot of advice that's medical or relationship advice that's probably not, they don't know all the circumstances. Like, they'll tell you, stay with your husband, or, you know, keep working on that relationship, or no, you should divorce him, or maybe you should, you know, look out for a person whose name is Jordan, who's going to be coming into your life soon, and he's going to be your life partner. Well, what if you meet somebody named Steve who's really awesome? You're going to say, nah, Steve, Forget you. I'm waiting for Jordan, you know?
Easy, Marianne. It's just a good old-fashioned haunted hotel.
As a skeptic, the problem for you must be convincing people who would normally believe a medium or in ghosts or in the supernatural, convincing those people that this is a trick, it's a psychological sleight of hand. But these are quite stubborn superstitions.
Right.
And they've been part of human thinking for millennia. Is it quite difficult to fight against that?
You know, that's a great question. I'm trying to be, you know, over the years as I'm getting older, I'm learning that you really have to be kind. These people who believe, they're not stupid. They don't deserve this to happen to them. They just get conned because they don't know. They're trusting, loving, wonderful people who are in desperate or vulnerable situations. And it's like a whack-a-mole thing out there. There's so many psychics. The TV shows keep happening for these psychics that we know are, you know, defrauding people. They're still getting TV time. They're still getting shows in Vegas. They're still getting things happen. And it's frustrating. But then I think about these people who reach out to me every few weeks and say, I read your article. Now I understand what was happening to me. And thank you so much. Bless you. Please keep up the work. You know, he didn't take a lot of money out from me, but at least now I know. You know, I get frustrated and sad. And then somebody writes to me and says, you're doing a good job. You know, you put the content out there for people to find. You're not going to argue people out of this. Awful lot of people who come to me and say that they have seen the light. They understand now. Well, they've seen the light, but they've seen the light for that specific psychic. So we don't try to debunk all psychics. We just say, in the case that you were talking about, the psychic you were talking about right now, this is what I think he did. And I'm fine with that. I just want to try to put the bug in their ear.
I'm sorry you had to go through all this. It's time for you to find peace.
That was Susan Gerbic, co-founder of the Monterey County Skeptics. If you want to hear more of that interview, you can get a longer version by subscribing to the Hey Lesson Patreon. For $2 a month, you get all of the unabridged interviews that we do with our experts. So in this case, if you wanted to learn, for example, how mediums are benefiting from the COVID-19 pandemic or the important distinction between a magician and a medium, Susan does talk about that stuff in the unabridged version for supporters. Just go to patreon.com/heylesson or click the link in the show notes below. Also, being a supporter is just being helpful. We don't have any ads on Hey Lesson. We don't have any sponsors. So even if you aren't listening to every one of these unabridged interviews, you're still helping us to keep going, which is nice. Edwin, have you ever been to see a medium?
I have not. I don't think I have. I've been to see sort of performances that are kind of similar. I mean, I could recognise from Susan's descriptions some of the kind of the artistry of it. But no, it was an interesting introduction to the kind of the techniques or the graft of being a medium or a psychic or whatever. It makes, like, I mean, the whole idea of kind of reaching for generalities makes sense to me, obviously, and you know, kind of reading up on people beforehand so that you can kind of get a sense of how to pretend you've been in touch with their relatives. I mean, that all seems fairly intuitive.
The cold reading thing especially is very reminiscent of, like, astrology, and you're reading your horoscope and thinking, well, this definitely applies to me, but it's actually just very vague statements or sentiments about how you will meet someone who interests you, you know?
Yeah, it's impressive. And actually, it made me think that at the medium, the game obviously treats it all as literally true. Many of the questions that come up in Susan's analysis don't really come up in the medium, because it's like, no, this is literally the case. You can go over there, there's a huge scary monster, hide behind this crate, it's coming to get you. Whereas it sounds like there's kind of a more interesting game in some ways to make about the idea of being a kind of crackpot medium and, you know, trying to kind of like convince people, like gathering information, like, you know, wowing an audience. You could kind of imagine it as a sort of a balance of, I don't know, Phoenix Wright, Ace Attorney and Guitar Hero, where you've got like an audience and you've got to boost their kind of believe rating, you know, sort of say the right things at the right times. You know, I'd quite like to play that. Whereas the medium, the game, was a little bit sort of mixed, I have to say.
There's definitely room for a game about a medium who's a complete phony and a fraud, who subsequently gets haunted by some kind of spirit, almost as recompense for their fraudulent behavior.
Yeah, and you could imagine, you know, being the investigator would also make for a fun game too. The person sitting in the crowd, you know, having assembled these fake Facebook accounts and whatever it may be, trying to catch them out. I mean, again, Phoenix Wright does in fact have ghosts in it, doesn't it? So it's kind of essentially this already. I just have to work out what to shout instead of objection.
Not real.
I'm sure we can think of a more elegant version of it than that, but like, yeah, something like, you know,
hot read.
Yeah. I'm getting a feeling.
The medium in this video game, like you say, she's not a tele medium. I think she's called Marianne.
Yes.
She's not a hotel showroom medium. She's a bit different. How is she different to what Susan would have described?
Yeah, most obviously she's not trying to make money from it. She kind of sees it as a bit of a curse. Obviously it becomes practically useful to her. But a lot of the game is about finding out how exactly she got lumbered with this ability and, you know, whether it has any kind of redeeming value whatsoever. I don't want to kind of like spoil too much, but the kind of the wider story deals with kind of a lot of questions of kind of parental or more accurately patriarchal abuse and how that may or may not be linked to the kind of the question of how she has these supernatural powers. So, yeah, she's very much not trying to kind of con people out of their cash. She doesn't really have an audience most of the time. Most of the time her audience is various spirits and just, I don't know, the creepy ambience.
The game doesn't really go down that road of being a money-focused career of showmanship. It's fantasy, pretty clear and simple.
I feel like it could, though. I mean, when you meet her, she's a young adult, so she's obviously, you know, been around. She's grown up in this orphanage. She's, you know, grappled with her abilities. And in some ways, that would have been a really interesting part of the game, to have somebody deal with these, you know, evolving talents. And then also with the disbelief of the people around her, you kind of get the sense that her, you know, her father figure early on, you know, credits her abilities. But, you know, she doesn't really have to worry about people not taking her seriously, because most of the time she's just on her own in a big scary wood.
Why do you think the idea of being able to summon and speak to the dead is such good video game fodder? Like, what's captivating about that?
Well, in this game specifically, there's a kind of, it's almost like a callback to, you know, the Midway games of the noughties. I don't know if you ever played any of them, but the kind of games like Second Sight or PsyOps, which are kind of all about, they're sort of supernatural adventures, and they're all about taking that headline ability, and, you know, which is usually a fancy piece of technology, as it is in this case, where you have this split screen dual reality mechanic, and just kind of really making that the point of the thing in a quite sort of like quite charming kind of B movie kind of fashion. An element of this game's appeal is trying to reach back to that, but it gets confused because it also wants to be a kind of a dark and moody, gritty psychological adventure where, you know, you're uncovering extremely unpleasant things about yourself and about other people. And yeah, the enjoyment, if you can put it that like that, is of kind of getting to the bottom of who you are. So yeah, but more generally, and there's any number of ways that, you know, summoning the dead can be fun in a video game.
It's pitched as kind of a horror game, but on the horror scale, I don't know how big a fan you are of horror in particular, but on your horror scale, where would you rank it? Like, is it Amnesia level scary, Silent Hill level scary?
It's probably, it kind of wants to be Silent Hill and Amnesia. Like, in particular, it wants that kind of just sort of slow burn ambience that Silent Hill, the classic Silent Hills have, where it's not so much things jumping out at you as just hearing the radio static in the fog. And it wants I guess the kind of the compositional intelligence of Amnesia and the kind of the question of sanity. But really, it's quite a kind of a gamey construct. One of its kind of errors, I think, as a horror game, is that there's kind of basically one main monster, and you see more or less the full form of this monster pretty much the first time you encounter it. I mean, it's in the shadow, so it is still a threatening presence, but there's no, like, you have no sort of ambiguity about what it is, the fact that it is a monster. And then you, even better, you have to interact with it at first. Firstly, by running away with it in a kind of like a reflex-driven gauntlet run, which took me about sort of 3 or 4 attempts because I was getting confused by the camera angles. And then you have to do a sneaky stealth mission. And again, you can see the whole thing. You can see the creature clearly. It's stomping around looking for you, and you just wait for its view cone to move away and go past it. So it's not particularly, like, I think it's quite a good monster in some ways. It's, apart from anything else, it has a voice performance from Troy Baker, who is, you know, Mr. Ubiquitous Voice Man, which is a little bit Grinch-esque at times, a little bit kind of Jim Carrey in The Grinch, but is all otherwise also, it's quite, you know, disturbing. But it's just the way they frame it and present it. It doesn't actually inspire unease. It's more about kind of just feeling inconvenienced by this thing which keeps getting in your way and requiring you to sneak or just, you know, leg it or whatever it may be.
Would you compare it to kind of Mr. X in Resident Evil 2? If people played that game, there's a big stomping hulk of a man who kind of walks around after you. There's a lot of running away from him, and it's more tension than it is dread. Is it like that, or is it even more simple than that?
It's not as persistent as Mr. X. I mean, Mr. X is, past a certain point in the game, he's pretty much anywhere. He can follow you anywhere in the police station in Resident Evil 2. It's more like small, you know, confined areas where it's more of a stealth obstacle. I mean, there's a good moment when, I don't know how much I want to give away, but basically there's a particular section where it's less visible and you realize that it can follow you into somewhere where you didn't think it was able to go and you thought you were safe. You know, that's a good touch. But, you know, the more you kind of encounter it, the more you realize that it's something that is going to be in a small area, and you can usually work out which area it is in advance because you can look at the arrangement of kind of hiding spots and how the camera's positioned. It's one of those things. It's like, you know, walking through the cover layouts in Gears of War before the locust attack. The unease disappears quite quickly, even though the ambience, the kind of architecture and mood of the game is quite good.
The split worlds thing that you've been telling us about, the kind of split screen where the screen was split into two parts and you'll see one of the real world as we would see it and then one of like a spirit realm. What does a spirit realm look like to a medium?
So it's actually, there's quite a, I mean, they I think the spirit world is inspired by a particular painter, dystopian sort of abstract painter. He was actually murdered in 2005, I discovered. And I'm going to horribly mispronounce his name, but I think it's Bekshinsky. And what it looks like in the game is there's a sort of a touch of insect hive to some parts of the spirit world. It's kind of papery surfaces, this idea of kind of like pulped up matter, and lots of kind of suspended bones and kind of things caught in webs. And then sort of the spirit world takes on different shapes at different points in the story, depending on which kind of like particular character you're sort of investigating at the time. And so at one point it's like a kind of a slimy tentacular thing. And then there's a kind of an area which is like a sort of garishly red lit bureaucratic maze of paper and filing cabinets. And those bits are all, I mean, it's, you know, it does have some good moments in terms of its locations, I think. I kind of wish it did more with its forests. It has some wonderful kind of like forest walks where the camera pulls back quite a lot and you feel nicely dwarfed by the trees. The split world kind of effect somewhat works against it because the puzzles it builds around the split screen functionality aren't particularly interesting. And its camera work is a bit lacking in the sense that while it's kind of aiming for that kind of disorientation you get in the classic Resident Evils where like the camera's set up blind spots and, you know, you're coming around a corner and you can't quite see the thing that's making a noise, those sorts of effects. It's aiming for that. But in practice, it just seems to make things hard to navigate. And when you have the dual split screen effect, it's, you know, obviously the screen is compressed and it becomes even murkier at times. So yeah, it's a mixed bag again.
And that split screen, it's not something that you can just activate whenever you want. It's kind of scripted moments that disappears.
Yes, it's kind of, it evolves over the course of the game. So you have a split screen functionality which kind of comes in at particular times, and then later on things become a bit more blurred, and you might have like areas where you're just purely in the spirit world, for instance.
The studio who made this, Bloober Team, they also made the Layers of Fear games, which are about artists who go mad basically and have kind of their own breakdown. They also made Observer, which is sort of a cyberpunk take on horror. How different is this to those previous games the studio has made? I don't know if you've played them or not. But
I have, yeah. And, I mean, it's not as good, I think, would be the kind of the summary. It feels like it's a passion project they've had. Like, I think they've been working on it since 2012, I think it was, at least. And it feels like a game that's sort of like been knocking around and they haven't quite been able to work out how to make it right, and they've sort of finally got somewhere, but it doesn't really feel complete. It doesn't have the Observer has that sort of cyberpunk dystopian setting and is set inside a single apartment block in Krakow, and it's just a very quite lurid at times and quite lumpy in terms of its pacing and various bits of the voice acting, but you know, quite compelling kind of idea of a sort of an Eastern European cyberpunk aesthetic. Layers of Fear, I think, is a bit more sort of in the realm of kind of horror cliche, but it's interesting because it is, again, it's a single environment. In this case, it's an apartment, and you're wandering around it, and the environment becomes more and more labyrinthine, and, you know, single rooms turn out to be entire mazes of rooms and things like that. And it's all, you know, it's good fun. It's kind of well put together. This feels like they've kind of got the framework of a third-person survival horror game from the kind of the late 90s and noughties, and they tried to put some of their more creative ambient and puzzle concepts into it. And it's just sort of doesn't really satisfying quite the same way.
So do you think it suffers from being sort of overly nostalgic for Silent Hill or Resident Evil, or is it trying to tap into that and it doesn't quite work?
Yeah, it's on the one hand, it's trying to capture a particular kind of game. It's a first for them in many respects. Like, as far as I'm aware, it's sort of the first game they've made which has this particular setup of a third-person character with fixed angles and a specific main monster. Like, Observer has a lot of people in it, but you are mostly on your own. There isn't really, usually isn't an antagonist or an actual person in the world for you to avoid. There's a couple of other characters. Whereas this is a bit more kind of, you know, there is specific, there's the monster around, and they have to think a bit more about how they navigate around the monster.
The monster itself, it's just that one big bad monster, right? There's no smaller enemies or anything like that.
No, there's just the big monster, and a kind of, oh sure, well, there are these moths who flock in certain areas, and basically
it's always moths.
Yeah, I know, they've got such a reputation. It's kind of like a bit of a touch of Silence of the Lambs, I guess, which has that kind of moth motif. But yeah, they're basically just a terrain hazard. They kind of flock in certain areas, and you need to gather spirit energy in the spirit world to be able to kind of create a force shield that lets you push through them. Otherwise, they just nibble you to death, as moths do, or nibble you to undeath, or whatever you call it when it's your spirit character.
Just to touch on the nostalgia angle, did you play a lot of Silent Hill games or old survival horror stuff that this might have been inspired by when you were younger?
I did, and I was actually, I mean, I'm a big fan of fixed perspective composition. You know, people don't really like it today because it's disorienting, and you know, it's quite hard to do it when you have like quite a murky, complex environment without just sort of hiding things from view. But I really like the sense of having a kind of a malevolent director waging war on you that comes when, like, for instance, there's a scene I always reference in the original Resident Evil when you're shown a cutscene with this horrendous monster being introduced and coming towards you, and then it reverts to in-game control and you realize that the monster is coming at you out of a blind spot, and you're like, oh, and so you just basically fire off a bunch of bullets into empty space and you can hear its footsteps. And that's, you know, that's an example of that kind of composition being used really well. This just kind of, it doesn't seem that assured. It's like it kind of, sometimes it has, I mean, like, again, in the forest environments, you kind of pull the view out and there's a nice sense of being dwarfed by your surroundings. And there's a few kind of bits where, like, the camera will not show you what's around the corner, or it will kind of swoop above you in a vaguely predatory way. And, you know, it'll be slightly kind of tilted. So it kind of like makes you feel uneasy. But a lot of the time, the angles just feel quite uninspired. You know, at its worst, it just kind of hides things from view. You spend ages fumbling around waiting for yourself to trying to trigger that interaction prompt, as it were. Yeah, so I kind of came away a bit disappointed because I'd like that style to come back. Obviously, Resident Evil has now abandoned it, and I think it's worth returning to.
I was going to say, it feels like quite difficult to know what is a cool moment where you're shooting into nothing and you can't see the enemy, and it's tense and frightening, and what's just a frustrating moment where you're shooting into nothing and can't see the enemy and it's annoying. You know, like, what today, I feel like a lot of what Resident Evil did in terms of its camera work, people would not like it today. It would hit the shelves and people would be annoyed.
Yeah, I think you have to very much target it at that specific audience of kind of throwback horror lovers, really. It's like, nowadays, it just kind of reads as archaic. I think people see it as unnecessary constraint, and they perceive the kind of the disorientation of it as being bad design, you know, as opposed to deliberate. Because there's this kind of like level of unease you get with that kind of game, which is just comes from the scene transitions. You go from one, you know, perspective to the next, and you need to kind of mentally recalibrate just a little to work out, you know, whether you're still walking in the same direction. And the kind of the anxiety of that, I think, is really powerful if it's done right, but it's very hard to do right. And today, the expectations are just not there for it.
I'm going to ask you like a fun question. This is marked as fun question on my little script here. So what would unsettle you more, finding the creature from The Medium under your bed, voiced by Troy Baker, or finding the animatronic robot from Five Nights at Freddy's in your wardrobe?
Interesting. I mean, what gets me about that question is the wardrobe and bed opposition. I don't quite know what you mean you're intending there, but I mean, definitely.
I'm just adding that in as a kind of a wild card. I don't want to have any kind of control in this experiment or thought experiment. I don't want to have any.
It just leaves the possibility that it could be both. It could be one under the bed and one in the wardrobe. It could be a pincer movement. But I think, I mean, definitely Five Nights at Freddy's, the animatronic robots. The robots are much worse than, you know, the monster in The Medium is good. You know, when you're not trying to sneak past it behind a crate or just running along a tunnel to get away from it, it is a creepy presence. But yeah, It's not one of the all-timers, I would say that much.
I'm surprised. It always surprises me how many people are really freaked out by inanimate objects that look like they could move.
Well, it's the context.
As opposed to a full-blown monster with weird Troy Baker voice.
Well, yeah, I mean, weird Troy Baker voice goes a long way. I think he's everywhere, you know. He's like, you know, our generation's Nolan North, or whatever the correct way of phrasing it. But and he does have a lot of flexibility, and this is him kind of doing a bit of a jokerish turn where you hear him kind of like crooning things. I think crooning is probably the right word, from the shadows, and whispering all sorts of ghastly things he's going to do when he catches you, and it all gets quite queasy, and there is an undertone of, you know, sexual threat, although I don't think it's just about handled responsibly enough. But you're with Five Nights at Freddy's, you're kind of missing out the key point, which is that you're chained to this desk. You've got these things coming around, you know, you can see them coming, but you can't get away from them. Whereas in the medium, you just go and hide behind a box.
All right, we're gonna leave it there. You've been listening to Hey Lassen with me, Brendan Caldwell, and my guest co-host this week, Edwin Evans Thirlwell. Thanks very much for coming on and sharing your fear with us, or your lack of fear, as the case may be.
Thank you. Well, it's great to be here and to hear fascinating things about mediums and psychics, which I will now go and read up further.
Is there anywhere people can find you online if they want to hear more of your thoughts about perhaps non-ghost games?
It's a terrible thing to ask me because I want to share my Twitter account, but my Twitter account is complex and involves spelling.
You can do it. Everyone else does it.
So it's dirigible. So, all right, here we go. So it's dirigiblebill. That's my Twitter account. Carefully designed to be very findable and memorable.
If you're listening at home and you have enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting us. Like I said before, if you become a regular supporter, you get extra goodies, including longer interviews with the scientists, the historians, all the other experts that we talk to. But you also get a bonus episode every month in which we talk about games more casually. We don't run ads. We rely solely on the help of good people. Good people like Bok Choi, one of our goodest supporters. Good people like Herendemonas. I hope I said that right. Good people like, this is the last one, let me just read it word for word. Milk is gross and bad for you. Thank you to all of those people who are our porpoise level listeners. But thanks also to the rest of the Fact Gang, without whom we couldn't afford to do this. If you have a moment, you could also help us by giving us a review on iTunes or wherever. You can give us some stars or ratings or whatever. Or you can just share the episode with anyone you think might be into ghosts or disproving the existence of ghosts. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. But for now, thanks once again to you, Edwin.
Thank you.
And please keep listening.